Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon or good day. Tom Foley again on behalf of Mr. Malik and myself. We are once again, it's our pleasure to introduce Billy Nellis from Philadelphia, who will be arguing the case on behalf of Mr. Jackson. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, thank you for this opportunity. If I may just take a moment, as I did the last time when we made the argument to the panel, to just set the table with what the error was in this case, what it is that we're talking about. And as I indicated in our prior argument, whenever Mr. Foley talk about this, it strikes us that just reciting what happened tells a lot of the story. Joseph Hurley was counsel for Bobby Jackson. He asked to approach the bench. He asked to talk to Judge Biferato, who would be the judge who would preside at trial and who would ultimately determine the sentencing. Judge Biferato asked Mr. Hurley whether Mr. Jackson knew what he was about to say, and Mr. Hurley says no, he doesn't know. Mr. Hurley then tells Judge Biferato that he's been in practice for 17 years, and in that period of time he's always been able to divorce himself from the facts of the case, with one exception, that exception being Mr. Jackson's case. He told Judge Biferato, first he described the facts in a manner much more aggravated than anything the state had indicated to Judge Biferato up until that point in time. He then told the judge that he had an absolute sense of revulsion towards his client. He told the judge, who he knew would be presiding at sentencing, that he reached the conclusion that his client ought to die. He told Judge Biferato, who would be presiding at sentencing, that he didn't even want to sit at counsel table with his client, didn't even want to visit him at the jail because he found him so revolting. He told the sentencing judge that he had a private conversation with Mr. Jackson about the case, and that as a result of that conversation, it created emotional responses in him, in Mr. Hurley, and that as a result of that conversation, he concluded that Mr. Jackson, saying this to the judge who would preside at sentencing and who would make the ultimate determination, he says, this man is guilty and this man ought to die. Two times he said that Mr. Jackson, his client, should be executed. Judge Biferato then orders the transcript sealed, and that transcript is not disclosed at any level, at any stage. This court did not know about it on direct appeal or in the prior post-conviction proceedings. Prior counsel did not know about it. Fortuitously, it's come to light today. And if I may just take a moment just to take something off the table off the bat, and that is that the state has made some kind of argument in the brief and when we argued to yourself, Justice Berger and Justice Holland and Justice Jacobs, that somehow this claim could have been presented earlier. This claim absolutely could not have been presented earlier. The transcript was sealed. It was not included in the record. This court did not have it in the record on direct appeal. The docket entry that referred to this transcript was mislabeled. It's entry 85, and it said psychiatric report. So prior counsel Kevin O'Connell, when he's reviewing the record, would have seen that, and he would have said, oh, that must be the report from Dr. Mechanic that was filed pretrial, who testified as a witness for the defense at the penalty phase. There was no indication, even from the docket sheet itself, that there was such a transcript in this record. There was no suggestion to any of the prior counsel from anyone representing the state that there's something that they should look into and consider as a potential motion to recuse. There was no disclosure by Judge Biferato at any point during any of the prior proceedings. And Ms. McFarland argued the last time that there was a lawyer from the public defender in the courtroom at the time that Mr. Hurley approached the court, and there was, and that was Nan Perillo. And Nan Perillo represented Mr. Talmo at the time. He was one of the informants. So Ms. Perillo was conflicted from saying anything to Mr. Jackson or any of his subsequent counsel about what had transpired because she's looking out for the informant. She's looking out for the person that she's representing. Mr. Hurley says these things in the presence of the prosecutor, in the presence of counsel for co-defendant Lachetti, in the presence of counsel for the informant, the public defender, but nobody tells Mr. Jackson, and nobody tells Mr. Jackson's counsel. And when we made the argument to the panel, We talked a lot about Gardner, and the court asked for supplemental briefing about Gardner versus Florida. And if I may, let me begin with a discussion of Gardner. The Supreme Court in Gardner held that when there is a risk that a death sentence may be imposed on the basis of information that the defendant has not had an opportunity to deny or to explain or to address, that's constitutional error. That's error under the Eighth Amendment, and that's due process error under the 14th Amendment. Normally, in those type of settings, the burden it would be on the state to try to show that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In Gardner itself, the court was not aware of what the underlying information was in the pre-sentence investigation report that the judge had been made privy to, parts of which were not provided to defense counsel. Now, the significance of Gardner in this case is as a due process basis for why there was error. This case is on all fours with Gardner. There was information provided to the capital sentencer. In Gardner, Florida's proceeding is akin to Delaware's. The judge is the ultimate sentencer. Information that the defense had no opportunity to address, to deny, to rebut. Information that the sentencer may have relied on in rendering the sentencing decision. And one of the issues before the court is the dual interpretation of Gardner that the parties have presented. The state reads Gardner as requiring that the judge actually in his findings say, I relied on this information, or that it be relied upon to support aggravation or to rebut mitigation. That's not what Gardner itself says. In Gardner itself, the Supreme Court expressly wrote that the danger is that the sentencing judge may have relied on the improper information, and the risk that improper information may have been considered is what creates the constitutional error.
Is it your view, excuse me, that Hendricks is wrong? Because let me quote from Hendricks, there is no Gardner violation unless the judge is both aware of and actually considers in sentencing information that is not disclosed to the defendant.
And in Hendricks, Your Honor, the 11th Circuit spoke in the context of the unique proceeding in that Florida case. Specifically, there was a hearing in Hendricks. Your Honor is very familiar. In Hendricks, there was a discussion between the judge before he became a judge and the co-defendant's lawyer. And there was a hearing where the co-defendant's lawyer was actually called to testify. And at that hearing, it became clear that there was no improper information exchanged between that lawyer and that judge. Nothing was elicited at that hearing to show that there was any impropriety. So the predicate for that holding in Hendricks is that there was no information that was exchanged. Here, we know information was exchanged, information that may well have affected the sentencing. And looking at another case that the state cited in its supplemental memorandum, the McKenzie case out of the Ninth Circuit, in McKenzie, there was a contact between the judge and a special prosecutor who had been appointed. And the district court at the hearing required a showing that sentencing was discussed between the judge and the special prosecutor. The Court of Appeals reversed, and the Court of Appeals said, no, that's requiring too much. Requiring a specific discussion about sentencing or requiring specific reliance on sentencing information disclosed in the sentencing findings is too high of a burden. The question is, was there a discussion between the special prosecutor in that case and the judge on something that might have affected the judge's ultimate sentencing decision? At the subsequent hearing, it was discovered that the only thing they talked about were fees. And so there was nothing in there that may or could have or might have affected the judge at sentencing. However, even under the most stringent reading, even under the state's version of the McKenzie initial opinion, where the inquiry was sentencing discussed, Mr. Jackson should be granted relief, because certainly sentencing was discussed when his lawyer told the sentencing judge twice that Mr. Jackson ought to be executed. Now, if you turn to Gardner itself, and Hendricks is the outlier. Hendricks is about as rough an opinion as you can get in this area, with the predicate for Hendricks being that there was nothing improper exchanged in the first place. But if you look at Gardner itself, I'll just quote from the Supreme Court. Gardner, the court said, the judge did not comment on the contents of the confidential report. The judge did not state on the record, did not say, the substance of any information in the confidential pre-sentence report that he may have considered material. In Gardner itself, the findings do not indicate that there was anything of special importance in the undisclosed portion. In Gardner, the only reference to the undisclosed portion was an inference to be taken from the judges saying that I gave the defense whatever they're entitled to. And as the Supreme Court itself summarized, it had no means of determining in Gardner what role such confidential information played in the trial judge's sentencing, or even if it played any role at all. The Supreme Court didn't even know.
Is your remedy a hearing to find out what the judge considered or did not, or are you suggesting this is a per se taint and there's no need to inquire into the degree to which the judge who heard Mr. Hurley's remarks gave them any credence at all?
The difficulty with a hearing to reconstruct the record, and I'll talk a little bit more about this when I talk about Stevenson in a moment, is it's very hard now after the fact to try to tease apart how much of it was an influence from what Mr. Hurley said and how much of it now, years after the fact, how much of it was an influence by the evidence itself. I think Justice Jacobs, when we were arguing to the panel, posed a hypothetical of there's no way to do a laboratory experiment. There's no way to pull apart to what extent was the judge's that highly personalized, subjective, individualized sentencing determination that, as the Supreme Court said in Caldwell, as Your Honor said in Stevenson, that a trial judge makes. It's very hard after the fact to try to pull that apart and try to figure out, okay, back in that point of time, how much influence did this have, which is why, Mr. Chief Justice.
I'm confused about why that would be difficult. The judge is still with us.
Yes, Your Honor.
He could testify by way of example. He could testify, I know Mr. Hurley and his personality very well. I know that Mr. Hurley had filed a motion to withdraw on the basis that he wasn't being paid. And at that time, Mr. Hurley may have been worried I wouldn't grant the motion solely on the basis that the family could not afford to pay him. And I considered it all just hyperbolic reinforcement of his motion to withdraw, and I paid no attention to it. And what if he testified to that?
And the Supreme Court confronted that kind of situation in Gardner. The Supreme Court in Gardner did not remand to inquire, well, this pre-sentence report information is not stated in Your Honor's findings. To what extent was there reliance? To what extent did you know that the person who prepares the PSI always says bad stuff about particular defendants or always says good stuff or whatever? The Supreme Court said it was the risk of unconstitutionality that required relief, that required a new penalty phase. And you addressed this in Stevenson. In Stevenson, you had a situation where the judge asked to be assigned to a specific case because there were, for legitimate reasons.
Well, let me ask the question this way. I understand the distinction between an argument that the trial judge should have recused himself, and that if you look at the language in Stevenson, it reinforces the idea that as soon as he heard those comments, regardless of how he might characterize them, there's at least a perception of bias that might have compelled him to recuse himself. But we know he didn't, and we know he came to the sentence that he did, and that occurred a second time, and that two different juries made the findings that they found. But if there is a hearing and there's an actual inquiry into the extent to which he comprehended Mr. Hurley's words and weighed them, and if he were to testify along the lines that I just suggested, where would that leave us as a matter of law?
I think as a matter of law, you still have the underlying problem that you discussed in Stevenson, and let's talk about that first. First, you have an appearance of impropriety, as your Honor just mentioned. And the appearance of impropriety comes about from the fact that this information was not disclosed to subsequent counsel, so there was no opportunity to make a recusal motion then. Because there was no opportunity to make a recusal motion then, you would now be after the fact asking the judge to put himself in a pretrial set and to assess, well, what would I have done if a counsel had said, you've heard this damaging information, you should not be presiding? It becomes a very difficult retrospective hearing to conduct, which is why in Stevenson this court did not order a retrospective hearing. In Stevenson, this court held that the appearance of impropriety, coupled with the fact that it's a capital case and there's a risk of a fundamental due process violation to the defendant, meant that a retrospective hearing can't fix the problem. The appearance of impropriety is still there. The difficulty is still there, Your Honor.
I'm a little bit confused now because I thought that the problem was not so much that there was no motion to recuse, because I could see more easily how that could be considered at some later time if we could, you know, get some assurance that the judge said, you know, this really didn't matter and you know, I was objective and so on and so forth. I thought the problem here is that defense counsel or the defendant didn't have the opportunity to present evidence or argument that would ameliorate the effect of Mr. Hurley's comments, even if Mr. Hurley's comments weren't given a lot of weight and weren't considered significant to anybody, that it is a piece of information that the defendant didn't have.
Yes, and Justice Berger, you read my mind. That's where I was going with the second part. That problem can't be taken away at a retrospective hearing. Let me put it this way. Gardner requires that the defendant be given an opportunity to deny or to rebut or to explain the harmful information at the penalty phase. That opportunity was never permitted here. And if you think about for a moment what would have happened if Mr. O'Connell had been given an opportunity to rebut, to deny, or to explain that information, two things happen. Number one, as the judge, Judge Biferato, if Judge Biferato has either an explanation provided, a denial, or a motion to recuse, the judge conducts an exercise where the judge weighs their subjective view, weighs the objective view, and even if a recusal motion is denied, the judge then bends over backwards to not be influenced by improper information. Your Honors have done this.
Well, I wanted to follow up on Justice Berger's question because as I understood the thrust of your argument from your briefs and the last panel argument, is that in addition to not having the opportunity to rebut it, Mr. Hurley attributed his conclusion that the defendant should be sentenced to death after a confidential communication.
Yes,
so there are only two people that were communicating, and that seems to heighten your argument that he should have had an opportunity to rebut it if Mr. Hurley is saying, as a result of my confidential communication with this defendant, I've concluded he should be sentenced to die. Is that correct?
Sir. Correct, Your Honor. And it's the source and it's the content, as Justice Berger, as you indicated as well. It's the source and it's the content. And as to the source, as to Mr. Hurley, and as to the content of what he was saying, that opportunity was taken away from Mr. Jackson because of the manner in which this proceeding occurred. And that error cannot be repaired with a retrospective hearing. That is the very nature of the prejudicial error in this case. And you have in the, excuse me, you have in this case, you have an example of what might have happened. As Your Honors know from the briefing, after this case proceeded to the appeal, Mr. Hurley indicated that he wanted to file an affidavit. And we gave him an opportunity to do that. We attached the affidavit to the briefing, and it's quoted in the brief. And Mr. Hurley, in that affidavit, says that the thing that Mr. Jackson did that he found so appalling was that Mr. Jackson, who, remember, was an 18-year-old, drug-addicted, mentally ill kid, Mr. Jackson laughed during the proof-positive hearing. And that's when Mr. Hurley decided that that was it for Mr. Jackson. Imagine now if you're Judge Biferato, and subsequent counsel, Kevin O'Connell, comes into court and says, that information that you heard from Mr. Hurley, A, you should recuse yourself, but if you don't rely on it, because that information is not reliable. What Mr. Hurley himself says is it was something else was the reason why he made those representations, not what he told you. It changes the whole contours of the case. It changes it even if Judge Biferato were not to recuse himself. And this is a case, if to look at it from a Sixth Amendment perspective, where the violation of the duty of loyalty to the client is stark. It's about as obvious an example as you're ever going to see. And the issue then becomes, what do we do with this violation of the duty of loyalty, with about as stark an example of misrepresentation of it's beyond ineffective assistance as this court has seen. And in that situation, you have a case here where the mitigating evidence about Mr. Jackson was that he was 18 years old, drug addicted, alcoholic. He'd been abused by his father, been abused by his stepfather. He was mentally ill. He had mental problems. And a reasonable trial judge, the jury was out for 12 hours at the penalty phase. A reasonable trial judge could have taken all of that and said, yes, I will reasonably find for life in this case. Looking back on it now, given what was planted in this record by Mr. Hurley, how could we confidently conclude, with the confidence befitting a case where someone's life is underlined, how could we confidently conclude under the Sixth Amendment that this error is not something that requires a resentencing? And that's the Sixth Amendment analysis that we've urged Your Honors apply. I see on my rebuttal time, so unless the court has questions, I'll come back up in a moment.
All right, thank you.
Your Honors, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarlane on behalf of the state. This was a case of overwhelming evidence. This was a case where two juries came back 11-1 for death. This was not a case where an experienced judge of many, many years gave credence to something an attorney said 4 months before trial, 5 years before he rendered his decision, ultimate decision. Five attorneys had gone by. A trial, two penalty hearings, and as I said, 3 years, five attorneys, two penalty hearings.
Does it matter?
Yes, it does.
But I thought the whole point here is not that we can rationalize that, a lot of time passed and this was a very experienced judge and on, and therefore we know that this couldn't have had any impact, but that the problem is that because the defendant didn't know about it, the defendant didn't get an opportunity to make whatever kind of presentation he wanted to make to thoroughly eliminate the vestiges of any prejudice that may have caused.
Well, first of all, the defendant knew that something prejudicial had been set up there and never sought out a transcript. That he was told it was going to be prejudicial. He knew that.
But the transcript was filed under psychiatric proceedings or something like that.
Yes, it was. It was misfiled.
How could it have been filed?
Yes.
How could it have been found?
It was there to be found if someone had searched through the record thoroughly, which his attorneys now did. Nevertheless, it was not evidence. There was no fact to rebut. There was no factual information given by Mr. Hurley to the judge which could be rebutted. It was Mr. Hurley's opinion, and he said based on what he saw at the proof positive hearing. What
if it is the kind of information that a trial judge hears in anticipation that there is a possibility, if not a probability, of a penalty hearing down the road, and the prosecutor knows that the trial judge has heard that, is it not akin to Brady material that the prosecutor should have shared with the new attorney before trial so the new attorney could prepare to meet whatever assessment of the prejudice that information might generate in that attorney's mind?
Given that the information was already in a defense counsel's purview, it would not have been the state's responsibility to take over that. I mean, Mr. Hurley knew what had gone on there. He would presumably have to continue to turn over whatever he had to the subsequent counsel. Nan Perillo was there, and she was actively advocating for Mr. Jackson, although she was not representing him. And she certainly didn't know that her office was representing Mr. Talmo. She knew that, she may have known that, but she did not know that that was a witness at trial. She was trying to actively stay in the case and had met with Jackson and had spoken with his mother and was certainly looking after his interests at that motion hearing.
So it wasn't accurate when it was represented to us just a few minutes ago that she was not there representing Jackson?
She was
there representing, I think it was referred to as an informant?
She was not there representing Mr. Talmo. No, she was not. She was there. Her own memo that was included in the defendant's appendix, her own memo to the file discusses how she investigated the case. She already had the file. Mr. Hurley had given it to her. She had met with Mr. Jackson. She had met or spoken with his mother.
Well, was there at no point when the state understood that ultimate trial counsel and counsel who represented Mr. Jackson at his penalty hearings did not know that information? The state just assumed that all along counsel knew it and just chose not to make it an issue?
It did not appear to be an issue to anyone who was at that sidebar, Your Honor. It was not brought up again. No one discussed it. And because it was an attorney trying to get out of representation. And, yes, there was hyperbole. It was Mr. Hurley. It was Judge Biferrato. The idea that attorneys can't speak to the judge about things that may be prejudicial to their client during litigation is just not a feasible rule to have. Trial judges consistently hear things. They're exposed to actual evidence that they suppress, that they keep out. There was not even any evidence in this. Look at the Capano case, where there was a conference every morning before trial where Mr. Capano's attorneys would discuss the difficult problems they were having with their attorney. They had to talk about the fact that they expected him to perjure himself on the stand. These are things that trial judges hear. They're exposed to them, and we expect them to follow their own rules of judicial conduct.
Attorneys have an ethical obligation not to present perjury. So that's something that comes up whenever your client has the potential to perjure themselves. Do you know of any other cases where, as the result of a confidential communication between an attorney and a client, the attorney said, I feel I have to withdraw because based on my interaction with my client, I've concluded that he should be sentenced to death?
No, I'm not familiar with any cases where that is a part of the record.
Well, help me with this language that we quote in Stevenson. Every procedure which would offer a possible temptation to the average man as a judge not to hold the balance nice, clear, and true between the state and the accused denies the latter due process of law. How do you apply that language to these facts and then conclude that this case and its facts are not subject to a straightforward due process analysis?
Because here, there is no, the judges hear things like that. They don't give it. There was no evidence presented to him that would lead him to think one way or another about Jackson. What Mr. Hurley said was that when I heard what was going on at the proof positive hearing, it evoked emotions related to things that were going on with his wife. This was a murder that happened in Hockessin, where they thought people lived and could go into the. Obviously, he and his wife had issues about security in the garage. And this is what hearing the details at the proof positive hearing evoked in him. And that he, in fact, advocated for his client that someone else should represent him who can zealously fight for his life. And that was what Hurley said. I can't do it. Someone should.
But we put that in the context that Hurley had 17 years of experience, was a well-known defense attorney, and he'd represented a lot of people accused of a lot of different things. And he said, I just can't represent this person. You're saying that that's something that would not be memorable. That of all the people he'd ever represented, Mr. Jackson was the exception to the rule, and he couldn't defend him. And my question is, wouldn't that be memorable?
Well, if you put it in the context of the judge was aware of what testimony had been elicited at a proof positive hearing, perhaps the judge had looked at that evidence and looked at Mr. Hurley and not found that particularly memorable.
Was he the judge at the proof positive hearing?
That I'm not sure of, actually, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that relevant to the argument you're trying to get us to accept?
Well, I mean, it was public.
Well, my question about memorable is, wouldn't it be memorable to the trial judge that Mr. Hurley made that statement? Of all the defense attorneys who represented people for 17 years, wouldn't the judge remember that even Mr. Hurley couldn't represent this man?
Given that it was Mr. Hurley, Your Honor, no. Mr. Hurley... Can you take judicial notice of the fact that he tends to use hyperbole to a large extent?
And use his personal life experiences with his wife as an example?
Yes. Well, he uses personal experiences in his arguments at trial, too. But here he did use a personal experience with his wife. And it clearly, if it had struck, for example, Nan Perillo as something really significant, she would have done something. She was very concerned about Mr. Jackson's representation.
Well, don't you think the fact that the judge sealed this immediately indicates that the judge thought something significant had just occurred?
Well, what that indicates is that the judge did exactly what he should have done and prevented that from tainting a jury pool by having that possibly be public. Because if he hadn't sealed the transcript, then that would have been accessible and could possibly have been disseminated.
Goes back to my question. Something significant had just occurred.
Well, that would be the same if a trial judge is told, for example, back to the perjury issue or a suppression. If the judge may be able to look at that and disregard it in terms of his decisions, but may not want the public or the jury to consider that. I think that to have a rule that if an attorney says something that's at all prejudicial to about his client to a trial judge would just create judge shopping. Oh, all I have to do is say something nasty about my client and I'm going to get a new judge, guaranteed, every time. That is not a rule that this court needs or should have.
Well, Ms. McFarland, if we were to credit your argument, how could it be articulated in Gardner terms?
Well, Gardner...
That is, does Gardner even permit that argument, even if all of the factual predicates of your argument are true?
And in Gardner, first of all, Gardner was a case where the jury recommended life and said specifically that the mitigators outweighed the aggravators, and the judge came back and said, I've looked at this, that, and the other, including the PSI report, and I'm sentencing him to death, going against the recommendation of the jury, and by the way, there were no mitigators. So that case, just factually, was very, very different than this. Second of all, the court discussed the fact that he had factual information that he relied on in the PSI, and that was the problem. What information that he had that was factual differed from what the jury was exposed to that changed, that made him come out so completely differently than the jury. That's Gardner.
Well, can't you make the same argument here? There was factual information that Judge Biferrata was exposed to. Then it may not have been facts that related to the underlying crime, but they were facts nonetheless, and they could have influenced him. And isn't that precisely what the Gardner holding is designed to reach?
Well, first of all, I would not characterize Mr. Hurley's opinion as factual in any way.
Well,
and in a penalty hearing, the only thing you could do to rebut an opinion is put on an opinion that he was not a horrible person, that he was a good person, and those witnesses were on. You certainly wouldn't put, I mean, it's not the same type of information. And
you're saying there would be nothing to rebut at a penalty hearing, even if a motion to recuse had been made and denied. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And in terms of the motion to recuse, there was another motion to recuse in this case, and Judge Biferrato did do a subjective analysis of his own ability to rule in this case and participate in the case, and he found that he could, and that was upheld. Now, granted, that wasn't related to this, but when you do a subjective analysis under Los Feliz, you are required to look at the totality. He, in searching through what he knew or felt about the case, believed he could go forward.
Well, it's a two-part test.
That is correct.
What about the second part?
The objective part?
Right.
He did not, unlike, in contrast to Stevenson, where the judge affirmatively took action that could be read as an appearance of bias or partiality, here the judge did nothing except hear something. He did not act in any way that would lead anyone to believe that he had an interest in the outcome of this case in any way. And he followed the recommendation of the jury, two juries, 11-1 for death.
Well, let's put aside for a moment, had an interest in the outcome of the case, and focus on objectively, would a reasonable person in the community believe that a judge who had heard that comment from Mr. Hurley could hold the balance nice, clear, and true between the state and the accused when he decided whether or not to sentence Mr. Jackson to death?
Yes. Judges hear things like that, on information that confessions that are suppressed.
I didn't ask you whether that factually occurs, advertently or inadvertently. I ask you whether the loss objective test,
yes,
applied to these facts,
yes,
would cause a reasonable person in the community to question or to perceive that a judge would be unable, having heard that, to hold the balance nice, clear, and true between the state and the accused when deciding the penalty in this case.
I think that the public would not find a problem with that.
Explain.
Because this is what they expect judges to be able to do, to hear both sides and listen to the evidence that was presented and the recommendation of the jury and come to a balance.
Your view is that I don't know that there's a litmus test for anyone's view on this, but you're advocating to us that a reasonable person, having heard that the trial judge, who ultimately would be the sentencing judge when death is the issue, has heard counsel for an accused say, I do not want to represent this person anymore because he's such a revolting person that he ought to die, that no reasonable person would believe that that judge was tainted in any way in his assessment of the penalty.
Yes.
Appropriate penalty.
Just as in Gaddis, where, and I believe there was another case where a counselor told, where someone was told, a judge was told that the defendant was making threats, you still expect a judge to be able to put that aside. That is what judges do.
Well, I'm confused by your answer to the Chief Justice. You said the public would understand this because the judge heard both sides. In this case, the judge heard the state say, we're seeking the death penalty, we'd like Mr. Jackson executed. Then the judge heard the defense attorney say, I agree, Mr. Jackson should be executed. So,
and then he heard multiple attorneys after Mr. Hurley was out advocating for his life, and they also heard, and the judge also heard Mr. Hurley say he needs someone who can advocate for his life. He deserves that. I can't represent him. This was all about getting out of the case for Mr. Hurley. That was what it was about. And I'm certain that Judge Biferrato was astute enough to see that. He had already talked about getting out of the case earlier, and Judge Bifferato had tried to encourage him to stay in. You could save his life. And Mr. Hurley felt that if the evidence was so overwhelming that it would not be money well spent.
Well, Ms. McFarland, that may be one take, so to speak, that the trial judge might have had in reacting to Mr. Hurley's comments, but it's not the only one. I mean, the other possible take would be, you know, this is an experienced trial attorney, 17 years. This is the first time that's ever happened. There must be fire when there's this kind of smoke. Aren't you asking us to hold as a matter of law that there's only one reasonable way that a trial judge could interpret Mr. Hurley's remarks?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In this case, this was not, the judge was not the finder of fact in terms of guilt. A jury.
But he was the ultimate adjudicator of what the sentence would be.
Yes, that is true. But he did hear the entire trial where there was overwhelming evidence against Mr. Jackson. And he also had the recommendation of a jury, 11-1, not once, but twice.
Does that negate the ruling of, I mean, how is that relevant given the Gardner case?
Well, all the cases that the state has pointed out post-Gardner allow for a harmless error analysis, every one of them. And in this case, if that's where you want to go, the harmless error is certainly here. To expect a judge to remember this, I find not quite believable. He made no reference to it. Nan Perillo would certainly have said something if she found it significant. The prosecutors had no memory of it. So to expect that a judge, an experienced judge in a capital case, would go against his judicial rules of conduct and take into account comments of an attorney. We expect juries to follow the rules and to follow the law. We also know that our judges must do that too, and so did Judge Bifferato. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Your Honors,
counsel, let me please ask you, in your opening comment, you made the major thrust of your position was that if Mr. Hurley's comments had been disclosed to successor defense counsel, then successor defense counsel could have done one of two things. First, move asking Judge Bifferato to recuse himself, and in the event recusal was denied, then to rebut the thrust of Mr. Hurley's remarks at the penalty phase. Is that correct?
Or deny. And in addition, okay. The claim could have been raised on appeal as well. But, yes, you're correct.
All right. But let's follow through with that. Suppose there was a motion. There was disclosure. There was a motion to recuse. Motion to recuse is denied. And we're now in the penalty phase. How exactly, under what scenario would the defense counsel exercise the defendant's right to rebut Mr. Hurley's comments? How would it even come up?
Yes, Your Honor, but the first place where that challenge would happen would be in the context of the motion to recuse. And two things happen.
Well, we've already gotten beyond that.
No, I know, but I'm just saying that the first place to deny that information is at the motion to recuse hearing. You wouldn't necessarily do it in front of the jury. And so Mr. O'Connell, subsequent counsel, would have said to Judge Bifferato first, based on what you heard, you should recuse. As a result of that, two things would happen. Number one, Judge Bifferato may say the public's confidence would be undermined by this. I can't take what I heard out. I'll recuse. Secondly, Judge Bifferato could have said, as you said, Justice Jacobs, I'm not going to recuse. And then what happens? What happens is then Judge Bifferato bends over backwards to not allow that information to have any effect. Judges consider what the parties bring before them. Judges make decisions based on what the parties bring before them. That's why Stevenson and Gardner emphasize that adversarial testing.
Well, if I understand
Mr. Chief Justice.
If I understand the state's argument, it is that that's exactly what would have and did happen here, that Judge Biferrato would have discounted it. A, it's pretrial. B, it's from Mr. Hurley, who's known for his hyperbolic personality, his grandstanding generally. He knew it came in the context of a motion to withdraw. He knew, I think the state, one could argue importantly, makes the point that it's non-factual. There's not a single fact to back up his opinion, as at least it's been recounted to us today. Isn't all of that consistent with the same posture as denying
or
refusing?
No, because to accept the state's argument, we would be creating an irrebuttable presumption that in every case where a judge hears something harmful, the judge automatically takes that out of their head, just by virtue of their being the judge. That's what undergrinds the state's argument here. And that's not the way that our criminal justice system works. That's not the way that Stevenson and Gardner say it works. The criminal justice system works in an adversarial format. Issues are brought to the court. The court decides the issue that's brought before it. And in this case, that would be you should not rely on any of that information to Judge Biferrato. And then
what would happen in the penalty phase? And I haven't gotten an answer to that question. I guess it would be nothing, correct?
At the judge sentencing, a reasonable lawyer would have said, like we did to Mr. Hurley, why did you say that stuff? And Mr. Hurley provided an affidavit when this case came up before this court on appeal where he says, I said all that stuff because Mr. Jackson laughed during the proof positive hearing. That affidavit denies, negates, belies what he said to Judge Biferrato. The sting is taken out of it. Mr. O'Connell never had a chance to do that because the transcript was sealed, because there was no opportunity for him to bring the issue to the court, as he has said in the affidavit that he has filed.
Well, that would have been brought to Judge Biferrato's attention in the recusal motion.
Or at the judge sentencing. In some place or other, a reasonable lawyer would have said, why did Hurley say these things? And we know the answer now to why he said these things. He said these things on the basis of something that's not what he represented to the judge. He said this because it offended him that this 18-year-old brain-damaged kid laughed during the proof positive hearing. That's very different than the state's been on it. But the point is to speculate about all this and to try to recreate all of this is the difficulty that this court cautioned against in Stevenson and that the Supreme Court cautioned against in Gardner, which is why both this court and the Supreme Court have said if there's a risk that improper information may have influenced the sentencer, that risk requires relief. Unless Your Honors have additional questions, I have more to say, but I see my light is on.
I understand. Thank you. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.